Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Now to a conversation that testifies to the power of a strong, loving family to overcome even our DNA, the hard wiring of our bodies. In 2005, after decades of studying the brain scans of psychopathic killers, Professor James Fallon made a startling discovery about his own brain. It was this discovery that saw him revise a core scientific belief that he had taught and stood by all of his career. In welcoming Professor James Fallon to Open House, we begin with a definition. What is a psychopath?
It's a personality disorder. It's one of 10 personality disorders, and it's mostly characterized by a lack of emotional empathy. There's a couple of kinds of empathy, but a lack of emotional empathy, no sense of conscience. There could be a sense of ethics, but in terms of moral conscience, there's very little of that in psychopaths. Some have poor impulse control, and they're very manipulative. Somebody uses a lot of charm, and they're very glib and manipulative, and when they have to, intimidation and violence to control others, and to, you know, they basically to satisfy their own nut, their own selfish needs. And they take what they want anytime. There's no guilt or regret, but they have low anxiety. So they're they can use that charm and that lack of what we can read in most people, which is anxiety. They don't have that, and they use that to great advantage.
Professor, you've variously described there a number of traits that many people have, and yet they're not considered psychopaths. Where's the demarcation?
Well, that's a perfect question, Duane. It's, you know, there are some behaviors that are, they're well in the context of somebody's job and what they do. You know, to be glib and just charming and have a sense of worth and all of that, and being manipulative, any good salesman has that. It doesn't mean they're immoral, but everybody knows that they're really, the idea is to manipulate you just to buy something. But since everybody knows it, it doesn't really count as psychopathy. And so it's not the behaviors per se, because these are all natural behaviors that in the normal person, that it will be called up in the context of defending yourself, defending your family, or to be able, if you're starving, to get what you want without using violence. So these are all normal behaviors, but in the psychopath, they're out of context. It's when the person really doesn't need it, other than just to satisfy selfish needs and to play with people like a cat does with a rat when they're not going to eat them. That's what it looks like. So it's the context that makes it so objectionable and clinical for a psychopath.
Let's turn now, Professor, to those brain scans of convicted psychopaths, as well as those looking to use mental incapacity as a defense in a trial. You developed a theory about the physical shape of the brains of psychopaths, didn't you?
Well, starting in the early 90s, I was being asked to look at these scans. They were positron emission tomography, functional brain scans at that time, but over the years, there were also fMRIs and SPECT scans, so different brain scans, and I was started out looking at one or two a year, but then a whole bunch of them came in the early to mid-2000s. And as I was looking at these, the whole group of them, I told all my colleagues not to tell me whether they were murderers or psychopaths or anything, or whether they were normal. And so I was sent all these, and some people, I guess, were schizophrenic, some were depressed, and some were impulsive killers, and some were psychopathic killers. And I put them into piles, and they were neatly separated out. And I didn't even know, you know, I had no idea whether they're normal or not. So it was quite easy to separate them out. And I think any neuroanatomist could have done it. You know, I had no special sort of art to this. It's just by knowing the brain. And I said, my God, there's a pattern. And there was really never thought to be a full pattern for a psychopath. And so I started to vet that in about 2005. And so I started to talk at law schools and psychiatry departments, et cetera, and to try to vet it out to see if that theory was rang true to other people who were looking at it.
It's at this juncture, Professor, that your story takes a wonderfully bizarre twist in a way, although disconcerting to some around you, where you're looking at scans and you make a discovery about yourself.
Right. So at the time, I was compiling all these different psychopaths and different kinds of murders, And I had those on my desk, and we were doing a completely separate study on the genetic basis of Alzheimer's disease and looking for those genes that were involved and interacted to cause high risk. And we had gotten all the patients that we needed, but we need some control. So I you know, volunteered myself and got some other controls together. Yeah. And we had the PET scans and the genetics done, and they all came back. And I was looking through the pile of them. They were coded, so I didn't know who was who. And they all looked very normal. And I got to the bottom of the pile, and there was one scan that was obviously there was something wrong, and it was a control. And I asked the technician to go check in the PET scanner and really check how the data were handled. And two of the technicians did that. They came back. They said, no, that's one of the controls. And so we got a potential murderer walking around as a control. And so I had to kind of break the code, and I looked at the name, and it was me.
Oh,
you know, this is when Gandalf shows up at your door and you're it.
Oh, I shouldn't laugh, but
no, you should, because I laughed too. It was ridiculous. And so I immediately, of course, I laughed it off. And, you know, it was a combination. We just started an adult stem cell company from findings we had in my lab on reversing long-term stroke and Parkinson's. I was busy with that and looking at the genetics of schizophrenics and Alzheimer's. So I kind of laughed it off, and I said, oh, hell, you know, I'm sure. I said, the theory must be wrong. Well, it turned out soon afterwards other people started to report the same thing, so the theory was not wrong. But I still said, look, I'm not a murderer, rapist, or a bad guy. I'm a normal guy, man. And so I kind of laughed it off. See, I never took this seriously. Until I went to Oslo, I was asked to give a talk with the ex-prime minister of Norway on manic, you know, bipolar disorder or manic depression, and which he had. And I gave the talk, and at the end of the talk, the chairman of the psychiatry department there said, first of all, you don't know this because you don't have this definition in the United States, but you're a bipolar. You're a hypomanic bipolar. You're always up, so you love it, but you're still a bipolar. And the second thing is my colleagues and I like to talk to you afterwards. So we met after the talk at a colleague's house, who was the president of the University of Oslo, and they said, you're probably also a borderline psychopath. And that's the first time, that was in 2010, when I took it seriously, because these people didn't really know me, but I had shown them all of my genetics, my scans, and all of my my whole history of the clinical and preclinical disorders. So when I went home, I started to ask everybody, the psychiatrists who know me, I'm in the psychiatry department, and then my wife and people, my friends close to me, I said, tell me what you really think of me. And they all said the same thing. They said, you're just about a psychopath. You have all these traits. And I said, all these years you've been telling me I'm crazy. And I just didn't. They said, you're not crazy. We didn't say that. We said, you have a lot of psychopathy. And they all said the same thing. And Dwayne, I got to tell you, after they did, I didn't care. I swear to God, I didn't care. It was like blew it off. One psychiatrist told me, he says, that's the problem. You don't care that you have this. You know that you've had this, and you just don't care. And it was really kind of a aha thing. So it was like they were right, but I still didn't care. And, you know, after all those years when I was a self-diagnosed normal person, then I started to get the diagnoses. It was weird.
What triggers it in some versus leaving it latent in others?
Well, this is the big question, and you're coming up with all the right questions, Dwayne. The theory, which turns out to look pretty good now, is that there's a combination of these high-risk alleles, genetics, a brain pattern that could have been done, you know, in utero or by early brain damage, and then abuse. Early abuse from birth until, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years old, or abandonment. And but it still didn't explain why I was not worse than I was behaviorally, even though I was, you know, had these drives all the time. And but I saw two of the gene alleles I had, and one was a serotonin transporter, and there was another related to dopamine, and they're warrior genes, and they are associated with the traits in psychopathy of aggression and violence. The thing is that they're only negative if you're abused early, and it turns out if you're treated with love early on, and you got a stable family, and you're taken care of very well, which I was, it negates the other negative genetic effects. And I said, aha, that's it. And I'll tell you, Dwayne, I never believed in the effect of environment before this. So I had to eat a lot of crow to my colleagues, because I always underplayed that role of a strong, positive family, nurturing environment. And boy, I had the most positive, nurturing family. And I think, you know, in my extended family, too, my aunts, my uncles, everybody treated me well. And there were probably a couple reasons for it. But nonetheless, I think that's what saved me. And of course, the psychiatrists I know who know about personality disorders that agree that that stable, loving, early family life negated it. And they saw it in me, and they took care of it. So I never believed that was true, but I was wrong on that.
What a potent message this is, Professor, that family life has the power to turn off or on a genetic sequence.
Yeah, and it's, you know, Duane, there's almost all these complex adaptive behaviors are regulated by 10 or 15 genes, plus these other regulators of genes, which are now becoming more important. And it turns out that the high stress, like you get from abandonment, or early abandonment, especially in early abuse, that, you know, it adds this little chemical group called a methyl group. It's called methylation. And that turns on and off these genes. So to me, you know, and to put it into something I could understand, I said, well, that makes a lot of sense, because you're born and that whole social brain, your whole limbic system, that part of your frontal lobe, orbital cortex, amygdala, it's if it sees early on a hostile world, a world of abuse, it could be any kind of abuse, but if it's a high stressor, it starts methylating. It changes those genes so they're turned off, and it turns on all the genes that have to do with aggression and violence, because your brain, that social brain, is born into a violent world or an abandoned world, and it's getting ready for it. It gets you ready for it, because if it's a violent world, you better be violent to exist, to live. So it's a protective mechanism. But in the same light, that what we thought was a dangerous gene, if you're treated with love, it's like that social brain early on in life sees a loving world, and it responds by letting all those kind of loving parts of you win over. You know, it's kind of the if you will, the super ego beating the id out. But it's all in us. But the amounts of it, it's kind of a crapshoot. You know, it's the genetics, but it's not a crapshoot, because in the sense that how you're taken care of from birth onward for at least the 3 or 4 years is so critical.
Professor, looking down the time tunnel, then, are we ever going to reach a time where medicine can turn off psychopathy in someone?
Well, one of the most depressing things is that personality disorders, especially the dangerous ones in terms of murder and abuse, and are like the psychopaths and also people with borderline, the idea is that there is no treatment for them. There is absolutely no treatment. And, you know, I used to be not so sure about the death penalty, and now I'm more against it because there's so many people who don't even appreciate what they're doing. They know it's wrong, but they're not driven the way the normal person is. But also, I don't think they should ever be let out now. I never thought this before, because there's no cure. There's no treatment. Once they get out, they do the same stuff. And this was a very negative sort of end to the story for me. But thankfully, my main colleague, Fabio Machardi, who's a psychiatrist, epidemiologist, and a geneticist, he just reported that these epigenetic effects that change your genome from negative to positive, they're reversible. They can be reversed. This is an unbelievable, wonderful finding. So in terms of, if we can find the way to uncode, if you will, if you look at it like a computer, to uncode or decode the violence in somebody or the person who's been bullied and how they react, but also the people who are the victims, can we undo that, you know, that PTSD and that trauma, this is the first hope I know about. It turns out to be my colleagues' group that did it. And so this all of a sudden has turned a very positive thing. So hopefully I'm wrong again, that you can't reverse psychopathy and you can't reverse PTSD, but God, it may be there. The mechanisms are set into us.
Professor, I know that you've technically retired from teaching and your research, but here's hoping that there are many more times yet to come in your life where you're proven wrong.
Yeah, the only thing that good happens around me to people, for other people, is that when I'm wrong. So, I'm old enough, and I've done enough bad things that I said, well, yeah, I might as well straighten it out if I can.
Professor James Fallon, thank you so much for your insights and sharing them in such a funny, entertaining, unguarded way. Have a great day.
Thanks, Duane.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.